join us on The Path Radio Mix online. And to get there, type in thepathradio.com. That's thepathradio.com. And enjoy free streaming music all day long. That's it. thepathradio.com. All right, now let's get to the main show, the monthly social podcast with me, your host, Guido Perino, as you go on with Guido. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Go On With Guido podcast for June. We've got another full show for you today. We're going to kick things off with CBC Radio producer Jess Milton of the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. We've got Peter Grab, who's going to talk to us about surfing the Great Lakes. And we've got Canadian songbird Kaylee Watts with a couple of songs for us to listen to. We're going to explore COVID-19 and freedom of expression in Canada in an essay form. And then we're going to close things off with a bonus from, frankly speaking, Frank Greco and Frank Gioia, two Canadian artists. And I am going to ask that you join me as we observe the Tkamloops, the Shewempak First Nation, during today's show. All right, folks, thanks for joining us, and let's go. All right, before we get started today, I wanted to tell you a little bit about one of our Promote Ontario / Canada small businesses. Johnny Prosciutto, artisanal Italian homemade products. We make it like our grandfather, or as we say, nonno. Naturally cured, old-fashioned, and delicious. The best part? We deliver straight to your front door. We offer free shipping when spending over $99. Order online at johnnyprosciutto.com and stay safe. And when you use the code GUIDORocks, you're going to get $25 off your entire purchase. That's at johnnyprosciutto.com. Listen, if you haven't tried johnnyprosciutto.com, if you haven't tried Johnny Prosciutto, period, you got to give these guys a shot. The food is really authentic. And why not take advantage of the Guido Rocks promo and get $25 off your order? Now, look, if you live in Ontario and you live in Quebec and you spend more than $99, you're going to get free shipping. Anyways, check out the site. I'm telling you, I've tried their products. My family's tried their products. My mom and dad, who've made this stuff, we made this stuff growing up. They tried it and they said, you know what? This is just as good as the stuff that we used to make at home. All right, without further ado, let's get to our main guest, Jess Milton, CBC Radio 1 producer of the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Here we go.
I'd like to welcome to the podcast Jess Milton, producer of the Vinyl Cafe, which aired weekly from 1994 to 2016. The show, with host Stuart McLean, offered a variety of entertainment, including music, letters, and stories, featuring the Vinyl Cafe stories, which were about a common family that had some relatable moments to our own everyday. Welcome to the podcast, Jess. Thank you for being here. How are you today?
I'm great, Radio. Thank you so much for having me.
That's awesome. And I appreciate, I know you have some busy days with kids at home. So again, I really appreciate that you're doing this. I have to tell you, though, that I feel like I've known you for a long time.
That's nice to hear. I feel like I've known you for a long time.
I'm wondering if you and I exchanged emails way, way, way back when, because I used to once in a while write in and say a few things, because Stuart would do the, you know, we'll read every letter sort of thing. And I was, did you read the letters? Were you the letter reader?
For a very long time, yes, it was me. And then right till the very end, I read a lot of them. But we also had two other women who worked with us in the later years in the office, Julie Penner, who is our music producer, who read a lot of those letters, and Louise Curtis, our associate producer, who read a lot of them too. So we certainly did read every single letter, whether or not it was me who read them or Stuart. I can't say that for certain, because we sort of sometimes shared those tasks. But if it was my name on it, we didn't, you know, if it was my name on it, then it was me. If it was Julie's name on it, it was her. It was
incredible. I have to probably go back because I'm thinking to myself, this is around 2000, the letter was around 2006 or so.
No, that would have been me.
But it would have been you. Yeah. So I've been listening to the show since I think about 2002. Okay. And I found it by accident. I was traveling from Sault Ste. Marie to Toronto, and there's just some stretches of highway where the radio didn't pick up a lot of stuff. And, you know, you're scanning the radio. And,
Wait, Guido, I think what you're trying to say is you had no other choice but to listen to it.
Well, no. See, I didn't know about it. So once I found it.
I do know that stretch of road really well.
You do, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going and I'm driving alone and I'm thinking, please, some entertainment, right? And yeah. And the dial lands on what I've come to know as the Vinyl Cafe, but more so what I came to know of Dave and Morley. It was during a Dave and Morley segment, which is, you know, the Stuart Stories. Now at that point, I'm going, the show had been on the air for about 8 years. And I'm trying to figure out what is this? Cause it sounds really cool. Right. And the format too, right. You know, he gets into the music and the storytelling. Anyways, at that point in time, when did you get involved with the show? Was it from the onset or?
No. I started on the show in 2003. So just after you started listening.
Okay.
At the time, there were only two people who worked on the show, Stuart McLean, the host and who wrote everything. And then the founding producer of the show, whose name was David Amer. So they were the only two, you know, people putting the show together every week. And it was, they needed some help. I started on the show part-time, 3 days a week. And essentially, they needed somebody to answer mail, to read the email. Because the show had just started to get popular, had more of a fan base. But also, email was just starting to become a thing. That's like,
right.
I can't wait till my kids are old enough to hear me say that. Because probably by the time they're old enough to have email, like, there will be no such thing, right? Yeah. I mean, that's like, that dates me a little bit to for you to know that, like, I got my start with this new fandangle thing called email. David Amer, the founding producer of the show, and Stuart were kind of like, we're getting a lot of these emails, like, come help out with that and just sort of help out with whatever else. So I worked at a sports television station for many years called The Score. And I was working there overnights, in doing live TV. And so I was able to do it because, and I was bartending as well. I was able to take this job, you know, just kind of 2 days a week because I was sort of like, well, I was already making enough money to pay my rent and live my life from these other jobs. And so I thought, hey, you know, I had Stuart as a teacher. I went to journalism school at Ryerson, and I had him as a teacher and, you know, if he were here, he would love to tell you that I was his second choice. He asked another person first. And they turned him down. And then I ended up, you know, like, working with him for 15 years and, like, you know, being the executive producer of his show and everything. So it was quite a funny. Anyway, I started off... I started off answering emails. I had him as a teacher and he needed some help answering emails. And it was, quite frankly, I had better choices. I had, you know, people thought, I remember talking to my dad about it and everyone thought I was a little crazy taking this job, but it just seemed, you know, I wanted to work on television as a reporter. And the path to do that was at CBC, which is where I wanted to work, was quite established. You know, you would kind of, you'd start off as a very, very small fish in the huge pond. Uh-huh. And I was doing that. I was working on I had worked on the National. I did my internship working on the National. And then you usually go out to one of the regions and then, you know, do some work there. And so I kind of knew what that world would look like. And I figured, hey, I'll go do this weird thing on this weird radio show with these two weird guys, and if it doesn't work, you know, if it's not interesting, because it, you know, I was interested in it because it was different and it was weird and kind of, it intrigued me. And I thought, and I also thought like, you know, it's not a huge risk, right? Like if I don't like it or they don't like me, I can just go back to, you know, getting some sort of job as a, on a bigger television show or something. So, but you know what, but I kind of fit in and they kept me around, thank goodness. And it grew from there.
So Jess, when you went in and you're saying, well, you know, they needed somebody to, you know, read the emails and the letters and things like that. And because now there's a bunch of years where I didn't listen to it. Was the format of the show already established, or did it evolve to what it was, to what I know it as, or the post, I guess, 2002 stuff, to what it was after you got there?
Yeah, it evolved over the years. So, and then, the big evolution happened before I was there. So initially the first two seasons were only done in studio. There were no live concerts. And, so there, nothing was in front of an audience. And then at some point, season three, I think it was, they did one concert or maybe two concerts live. And that's when David Amer, the amazing producer of the show, founding producer of the show, was kind of like, hold on, this is something, like, this is different. And so at that point, that was season three. And then season four, they only did two concerts. And then season five, that's when it got on at 12 noon on Sundays, which ended up being our time slot for the next, you know, 20 years or whatever. And that really would have, that would have been, let me see, 2001. That's really when it got its sea legs and it kind of, that was a
started
one.
To take off. Started it, to take off.
Yeah, it started to take off a little bit. And then because it was starting to take off a bit, they brought me in to help in 03. And I guess, and then I was there for a couple of years before David Amer retired. And then I took over as producer. And we changed it a bit again, like not right away. I was young and really inexperienced. I'd been very lucky to learn from David, but I still had quite a bit of learning on my own to do. And then I would say we started to change it a little bit more, maybe around like maybe 5 years into my tenure or so, where we did even more concerts live. So almost all of our shows were live. And they started, we had introduced the Story Exchange. That was the sort of the first big thing that I did. And that was in 03 or 04. And so that was a huge format change as well.
I love the Story Exchange. Story Exchange was awesome. Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah, I love it too. It was always, and Stuart did too, as one of our favorite parts of the show. So, but it, you know, when you started listening, it had already, David and Stuart had already gotten it to, really to its final incarnation.
So Jess, listen, an important question that I do ask my guests, and it's because I do it for the benefit of those listening who are doing, you know, career planning or development. And we've got, it's a variety of audience across Canada now that I've got. And you started touching a little bit on this, but how did you decide to become a producer? And you talked a little bit about the path. Like you said, hey, you know, I did some work at the Score. I did some stuff at the National. There seems to be a path inside CBC. How does this happen for you? And you know, how would someone go about producing that? You mentioned school, like, and Stuart was your teacher. You know, and I guess the other thing, as I get into my 20 questions, really is one question, but, are producer careers, are they abundant or are they limited like a goalie in the NHL?
No, there are more producers than there are hosts or on-air personalities in radio and television. Right. So for every, you know, for every host, there are often, it depends, radio and TV are different, but there are for every person that you see or hear, there are easily, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 in television.
Wow.
People that put a show together. So yeah, it's not a goalie. It's more like the defense, I would say. Like it's sort of a, but it's a bit of a weird, you know, there's a path, but there's a number of different ways you can go about it. I went to school for journalism. I knew I wanted to work in radio and television, but most people, and I would say in my experience, the best producers don't come at it that way. You know, there is a type, like a producer is a, I was telling someone this story the other night, like I was down in the States recently doing some work. Anyway, I ran into I've become friends with them, somebody who does some producing down in Washington on some political stuff. Mm-hmm. And he, when I first met him, we were in a room and we didn't know each other. And, but it was a, you know, it was a sort of a lecture series, and I was asking some questions. He was asking some questions, and afterwards he found me and he said, "So you're a producer?" And I said, "How did you know?" And he said, "'Cause I am too. And I can tell by the way, the kinds of questions you're asking." So there's certainly kind of like a, it takes, you know, there's a certain type, but it doesn't mean that it draws a certain type of person.
Right.
And also that type of, there's a certain type of person that is going to be good at it, but it does, but yet strangely they come from all over, from all different parts. So I worked with people at CBC most people I worked with didn't go to school for journalism. They had found their way, you know, they were academics who ended up, you know, finding their way into journalism that way, or they were teachers who, like, it is all over the map. Essentially what you need is you need to be curious. You need to be interested in others. You need to be a producer. You need to, your brain needs to function a certain way. So you kind of need to be the type of person that connects the dots. Hmm. So, you know, who sees one thing and wonders, what was the thing that led, you know, what was the thing that came before that? And then start sort of putting the pieces of a puzzle together. You know, mm-hmm. I like figuring things out in that way. And I like dissecting things in that way. Generally, producers are organized because they have to kind of be the ones who are, again, assembling a puzzle. And, you know, like, you can't assemble a puzzle if you've lost 10 of the pieces. So your brain usually has to function a little bit in that way. But really, I think it's mostly about making connections and allowing others to make connections too. So allowing the audience listening or watching to be there with you.
So would you say relationships are a foundation for it then?
That's a good question. Relationships are a foundation, but understanding relationships and understanding how things and people fit together, that's pretty fundamental. Like, you don't need to be I don't know what you meant by relationships, but you don't need to be like sort of an ultra connected person or anything. You just need to be someone who understands the world. And I think in order to understand the world, you need to be curious about it and be a good listener and sort of, things fit together.
I think that's where, when I said relationships, I was thinking, you know, be able to listen and understand. And you mentioned almost problem solving at times and connecting pieces and dots together. So it sounds like there you could take multiple paths to become a producer. You know, like through journalism, you've got the radio, and then it's just meeting people too and developing that way.
You don't start off producing your own show, or I certainly didn't, you know, and I don't think most people do. So you start off doing other stuff, and then you like anything, you sort of learn the skills and work your way up, and you'll find your home, right? Like,
So there's it's a progression, right, Jess?
Yeah, that's right.
So as the show progressed through the years, I have to ask, I had observed that Stuart was calling on you a little bit more, it seemed. There were a couple of times, I think, when I attended a live show, when he tried, and I think he even managed to nudge you on stage. You seemed a little shy about it, but he also often mentioned you by name during the show. That's how I got to know Jess Milton, right? It was like Stuart McLean and Jess Milton. Can you tell us a little bit about how the on-show relationship evolved with Stuart over the years? It just felt that you had something very organic, that you were two good friends, and that he was a little bit of a fan of yours, it seemed, at times.
That's really nice to hear. Thank you. And it also shows me how carefully you were listening to the show. So I'm not sure everybody would have picked that up. Yeah, Stuart and I became, you know, we worked together for a really long time, and we worked very closely together for a very long time. So we became extremely close. We also, you know, when you live that kind of life, like, we were on the road 150 days a year. So I always joked that I spent more nights a year with Stuart than I did with my husband. I mean, it's a joke, but it's like all jokes, it's rooted in truth, you know? So we, We had a very deep relationship, and part of that was because of the time we spent together, but it was also because we saw the world in the same way. And I think that's why, you know, I don't even know if I'm a good producer, but I was a great producer. I was a great producer for him because our vision was always aligned. It was aligned because our view of the world was aligned. And so it was extremely rare when we didn't agree on something. And there were certain things that he was better at, and there were certain things that I was better at. But we, you know, our skill sets complemented each other very well. But we were, you know, in some ways we didn't share a brain, but we shared eyes. You know, we saw the world the same way. So yeah, he loved having me on stage, and he loved kind of, I don't know why he liked that. I think, you know, we loved creating together. We loved working together. And so I think at a certain point he wanted to share a little bit of the stage with me too.
Right.
You know, because so much of the work that we did was the work we did together, but often he was out there alone. You know, I tried to figure that out over the years. Like, I tried to figure out, like, why is he doing this? Because he really, you're right. Like, he did kind of, like, drag me out. And it kind of drove me crazy. I'm not a shy person, but you know, my job was to make the show good. And I didn't think I made the show good. I thought that often sometimes took away from that moment. But he, yeah, he did. So I don't really know why he wanted to do that other than, like, he liked he liked bringing me out. I think it also gave those live shows like a bit of a, you know, peek behind the curtain, which he really liked.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. It for me, it, you know, watching it, it personalized it even just a little bit. Like he was already a very personal person, but he just personalized it a little bit more. It was like, hey, have a little bit of a look inside to what I deal with or who I deal with. And, and, you know, this isn't just me. This show just isn't Stuart. There's a lot going on here, like you said. And it just seemed like you were a big part of the, here's a little bit of what's going on here.
He was really good at that. Like he was really, really good at acknowledging the work that others did on the show. So I think that was the other thing. He just wanted, you know, he was trying to recognize my work, and that was nice. He was super good at that. And it wasn't just with me. He was good at recognizing everyone's work. So that was just his way to share the spotlight a little bit.
What a great compliment, right?
To
do that.
Yeah. He also loved bugging me, and he knew it kind of bugged me.
Yeah, there was he had that smirk about him sometimes right? So you mentioned view of the world. Now, did you, is that something you both kind of went, got to, or you realized it, bam, right off the bat?
We did not realize it off the bat. I was, you know, I was too young and inexperienced probably initially. And also, I had quite a bit of confidence. So in some ways more confident than I am now, because the world was more black and white when I was younger. But it's not necessarily, you know, I think in a weird way, even though he was so much older than me, we kind of in a weird way, like grew together as a partnership a little bit. So, but we did have that worldview. We're both, you know, I am a very optimistic person and a very positive person, not in that kind of like cloying way that, you know, like I'm not walking around with like slogans on my t-shirts or anything, it's just like naturally the way I see the world.
Your approach.
And he was like that too. And I think we both, you know, I heard him do an interview like this one time. We were in the back of the bus driving from A to B, and I was just sitting next to him working, and I heard only one side of the conversation. And the interview was about working and kind of like about creating things and partnerships. And so there was a lot of questions about me. And he said, the interviewer said, what makes her a good producer? I didn't hear that. I had to ask him afterwards what the question was. And he said, I've never, you know, I don't know. And then he sort of paused and thought about it. And he gave me what is, he taught me something about myself that day, which I didn't realize. He said, she never starts with no, like she sees the possibility in everything. And that was a huge compliment. And I didn't know that about myself. He taught me that about myself, but he was also like that. We both of us had this thing where we just sort of assumed something was possible. And it, I think it often was for us because we believed it was. So it was a really great thing. But we also, you know, that so we believed in the possibility and the positivity. But the other huge thing, and I didn't, you know, I grew up like this. My dad is very much like this, who I'm extremely close to. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know that this was different. But I believe the world is a good place, which increasingly is seen as a naive and kind of silly thing to believe in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I grew up in a home with a family who also, like, that was just something that was just the way of the world in our house growing up. And so I didn't realize it was weird and, you know, thought I was kind of naive until I went to journalism school, which is full of cynics. and Stuart was, you know, he liked telling stories the way I do. And he liked like talking about, you know, tough times and struggles the way I do too. But right. He liked doing all of that with the knowledge that like, for the most part, even when people do bad things, they are often trying to do good. So that's what I mean when I say the way we saw the world was similar. Like we, deep inside of us, we both believed that the world was a good place.
And it's interesting, Jess, because that theme sometimes quite often came through in the stories that he told about the Vinyl Cafe, right?
Okay.
You know, how things would sort of transition into something maybe not so good was happening, but turned out into something good. And I wrote down, seize the possibility. Mm-hmm. I'm just resonating with that a little bit and reflecting on that. Cause I think it's a big part of success sometimes. And there's something else that's resonating with me and you can validate it or not, but I'm just sensing between the two of you, there was a lot of passion for what you were both doing.
Oh, yeah.
In this view.
Yeah. And there were no, you know, and when I look at it now and now that I have a bit more of a, you know, quote unquote normal life, you know, it was a weird, you know, we had a weird life for those years, right? Like there were zero boundaries. So we had this deep working relationship and this deep personal relationship. So there were no, there were no boundaries. Like, you know, we would be talking, he would be calling me 30 times, like late at night and early. I'm more of a morning person. So I'd be calling him early in the morning. You know, we spent all this time together on the road. And then like, strangely, when I would go to take a vacation, Stuart would come on vacation with me and my husband. Like, it was like, it was a pretty funny, weird thing, but we loved each other very much.
And that's awesome.
It's just nice. And we loved our work, right? So it didn't feel like work. Like so of course you wanted to do it. It's like spending time with someone that you love very much, doing something that you love very much and that you care deeply about. So, I was extremely lucky to have that for
so many years. Just on the heels of some emotions here, in 2015, my wife and I had tickets to the December show in Toronto, and that ended up being canceled. Stuart began to focus on treatment for melanoma, and then in 2017, he passed. So the last time that I saw him live was at the Sony Center in Toronto on December 14th, 2013, which seems like forever ago now. But after listening to some of his stories immediately after his death, I disconnected from the Vinyl Cafe for several months. I didn't touch the books. I didn't touch my CDs. I just couldn't listen to it for some reason. I think it was because I was so disappointed that, you know, somebody like Stuart with so much talent and positive energy, for the world that he was no longer here and he had become part of my week to week, right? Mm-hmm. So there was something like, you know, just as a listener, as a fan of Stuart's, I was going through some sort of process. I eventually reconnected and I found comfort in celebrating, you know, all the things that Stuart had accomplished and all his works and in the show and everything. If you can, and I know it's a bit personal, right? But can you share with us the process that you went through from, I guess, the canceling of the tours and then I guess, you know, to the loss of Stuart and maybe where you're at today with all of that.
Yeah. So the canceling of the tours, that was a very difficult logistical thing. But when we did that, you know, the diagnosis, like his diagnosis and his, the projected outcome, it was, you know, something like 85%. Like it never occurred to us. And again, I said like how we both were maybe naively optimistic about everything. So it never occurred to either of us that he wouldn't make it through. Like, and not for a very long time, right? Like for well over a year, he was doing really well and things were going. And so the canceling of the tour was a difficult business decision. And we also felt really hard. We felt bad for people. Like this was we loved doing it, but it was also, we recognized that it was a tradition for many people and for many families who came together around the show. So we didn't want to let anybody down. Like that's when I think about it now, I don't know that we would have realized that at the time, but we didn't like letting anybody down. That was the hard part, but we were not worried about Stuart's health at all. Like it didn't even occur to us. And so, so that actually made it easier. Cause if, you know, imagine, and like now that I know what I know,
right.
If we knew that's where it was going, that would be a whole other thing. Right. But we were just focused on, you know, others, because we weren't worried about his health. So after the show ended, I guess we made the decision to end the show. It was on the radio for a while and we actually produced new shows in 2016. Like Stuart's health was really good for a year there, it was really quite good. So we were in studio. We just didn't go on the road because you never know when he had to be around for treatment, but also, you know, my mom had died from cancer 10 years before and it happened really, really quickly. So you don't know. But mostly it was like, he wanted to be around for treatment or, you know, if anything went wrong. But we were in studio every single week recording shows. Like we were just chugging along for a year there. Like everything was fine. And at some point, I guess we were kind of like, you know, he needs to focus on his health. I guess that was at the end of 2016.
Right.
And also we were conscious of the fact that, you know, I think the way the phrasing we used, it took us a while to sort of figure out how to express what we were feeling, but we did feel a little bit like we needed to get out of the way and allow others to, you know, that we had had a really good run and that, while we were enjoying this, we were still enjoying the work. It was a different thing, right? Like, you know, being in studio and recording those shows for that year,
right.
we really liked that, but that's not really what we did, right? Like, I think what we did best was get out into the country and reflect the country back to itself. So anyway, so we made the decision. That was an extremely hard decision. I remember sitting down to write that announcement. And I remember where, like to this day, I remember where I was sitting when I wrote it and what I was wearing. And I'm not an overly emotional person. And I was just bawling. Like I just couldn't, it was one of the hardest things I've ever tried to do. And I remember calling Stuart and anyway, so that was very hard. And then of course he died, which was, it was pretty awful. It was pretty awful. But, you know, honestly, at the time, it didn't feel awful. What it felt was, I felt extremely lucky to have the time with him that I had, you know, and for all those years that we worked together. But even like at the end of his life, I felt very privileged to have the time with him that I did and just to learn from him and to love him. And but the part that was hard, and this is where I might get a bit emotional, is that about 5 or 6 days after Stuart died, I learned I was pregnant with my first little girl. And I was quite pregnant with her, like 6 or 7 weeks, which meant she was there with me, with him, you know, which meant I could have told him, but I didn't know. And that was a hard thing. He and I talked so much about family over the years. And we, you know, he wrote about a family. Our show is centered around a family. So the idea that my husband and I were going to start our own family, I really wish I could have shared that with him. That's really one of my, there was a lot going. Yeah. It would have been a really special thing.
Yeah. I was going to say touching a special moment. And
I wish I could go back in time on that one. There's not very many things I feel that about, but that, I guess it was funny because that, like that, that obviously, you know, you have children. It changed my life so much. And also this person that I love so much and this career that I love so much ended, but this whole new life, this whole new chapter began at the same time. So it was a really, it was actually a really lovely transition. You know, I couldn't have had a family and had the life that I had with the Vinyl Cafe. It was too all consuming and I was away so much. My family was my road family and Stuart. And so now that was done, but I have a new family that I love very, very much. And that, I find just as fulfilling, but also that I learn from the same way I learned from him, right? Like my kids, I learn so much from them every single day. So it was for sure a difficult time, but it was, some pretty positive things came out.
And congratulations on the two children. Now, did you find that, cause you use the word family a lot and transition, mm-hmm. Did your Vinyl Cafe family days transition into your now family days? Do you find any parallels or?
That's a great question. I used to joke all the time with Stuart, you know, cause it was quite a task keeping him, together. And so I used to joke all the time when I was like yelling at him to get out on stage. He was always late. He never knew. He was always late. He was always running behind. He never knew where his glasses were. He was messy. And I'm like, well, it's going to be totally fine when I have a 2-year-old because I'm very well trained. I've had a 2-year-old for 15 years. And then the other thing is, so yes, just like my toddlers now, you know, Stuart was, it's funny, I've never really put it this way, but he, you know, toddlers are, they're challenging in some ways. And Stuart was challenging for all the ways I just said. I mean, he wasn't challenging in other ways, but he was a fun challenge. And he was kind of, you know, he was slow when he was, always losing things and always behind. And I was always having to he was a real deadline hound. So that was, but toddlers have this incredible thing where their emotions are, you know, they're very, they're close to the surface and they are these hyper aware beings. And Stuart was like that. Like, that's why he was able to capture the world so precisely, mm-hmm. I think, because he, it's almost like everything was a bit closer to the surface with him. So I was joking about the toddler thing, but there's also I'm amazed at what my kids say sometimes, you know, like the way they put things, like, and even the way they see certain things. Like, I was braiding my hair the other day and my daughter said, oh, I really like your Brussels. And I was like, but to her, they look like Brussels sprouts. And I just think that's so creative and cool, right? Like, just to have a mind that's so malleable and like open, that's really cool. And Stuart's mind was like that. Like, he was so open-minded and so, such a creative thinker that, like my kids, he never knew where she, you know, had trouble tying his shoes and had trouble getting out the door on time.
That's funny. Yeah. Thinking of all these things, what would you say, do you have a single or fondest memory of Stuart?
I think, when I close my eye, there's so many, but when I close my eye and think about him, the him that pops into my mind is that every single show, and we did like 100 shows a year.
Wow.
Every single show, I sat stage left, so to his left. So he'd be facing the audience, and I'd be to his left, and I'd be probably, depending on the size of the theater, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 feet away.
Uh-huh.
And he and I, you know, he'd look over at me all the time and sort of, the way I like to produce things is I pay a lot of attention to the audience. So I often sit like I want to feel them, not physically or anything weird and creepy like that, but I want to feel the energy in the room. You know, I want to see which lines are landing and which ones aren't. And I want to just sort of feel that. But, so the first week of a tour or something, I'd often sit in the audience, but then I'd go stage left and he liked having me there. I think it was a bit of a, you know, he always said like, I was a bit of a safety net to him. You know, he was out there and I was there to catch him when, if this, but, you know, we would have a sense of, we would think we knew what was going to work and what wasn't on stage, but we were always testing things out and trying it. And we were more often than not wrong. Like the audience, we learned so much from our audience over the years. And so, but sometimes we, like there was this joy in this moment of, he used to call it the moment of giving and receiving. Like as an author, you write things and you're not normal. Well, you're a podcast, Vito. Like you know, right. We're recording this right now. You and I aren't going to be there when the people listening, we don't get to be there watching them listen.
Right.
Like, and so, but we had this incredible privilege where we would get to be there the moment when our audience heard the show. We got to be there and witness it. And that was a huge privilege. And it's also allowed us to learn it and get better. And so sometimes we would come up with something, you know, he'd write a line or I would write a line or something in one of those opening scripts. And you know, I would say like, oh, Stuart, that's really good. You know, and we'd be killing ourselves laughing about it. And then he'd get on stage and he'd deliver it. And if it would land the way, you know, there's that, I love those lines that the audience kind of wouldn't see coming. And yeah. Then Stuart would deliver it and there'd be this like wave of laughter and he would shoot me a look that was like so satisfied. Like it's just pure happiness, right? Like just like joy bottled up.
It works
like that. Yeah, exactly. Like right. The way I imagine like an amazing baseball player, that sound when your bat hits the ball and you know that sucker's going out of the park, like that feeling of like, oh, this one's going to be a home run. Like that feeling, I would see it on his face and I would feel that too. And we would have just this little moment of connection that was ours alone. It was that's my favorite. And that wasn't one moment that would happen. It wouldn't happen in every show, but it would, you know, usually happen a few times on a tour that when I close my eyes and think about Stuart, I think about that moment.
You know, as you're telling me that, and I'm reflecting back on many of the shows that I saw him, he had this thing about him when he did that, when he delivered some of those lines. Sometimes I say, you know, you look at an art, a painting that an artist does, and I have this conversation with my kids sometimes, and I say, you don't have to fill the whole page. You don't have to fill the whole page to tell a story. Sometimes the white space is just as important as the colored the colored space that you're putting on with your brush. And when you told me that just now, I thought there were moments. Sometimes he would deliver some of those lines. And he would give the audience space to digest it because the audience would react. But, you know, he, you know, with his facial expression or his hands or his body or some other part other than just his words, he would induce the audience forward with it. And I think that was a gift. It was just a gift, right, to be able to do that.
It was a gift, but it was also a skill that he you know, he was an incredibly hard worker and he learned that over time. This is what I mean when I say when we learn from our audience, like we got to be there for that moment. So we would know, I mean, you know, we'd work hard at it. Like after the shows, we'd gather in the back of the bus and we would go through like line by line what worked and what didn't and, you know, rework things. And often I would be saying to him, you know, he taught me about, pacing, like he was a master at that, and pauses, pregnant pauses. Right. Like, you know, he was the one who taught me. But sometimes it is hard when you're out there and you're the performer on stage, right? It's easier for me to see them and feel them and hear them because I'm not also delivering those lines. And so, you know, we would mark up a script and say like, oh, you ran this a little bit. Let that breathe a bit. Give that a bit of room. And he was so open to feedback. He just always wanted to improve and he just worked hard at it. So he learned over the years too, like in the 15 years that I was with him, he kept getting better and better. He's a tremendously good performer.
So Jess, we're talking about audience and moments and you know, getting to know the audience and feeding off of them. In my exchange with you, as I set up this call, and I sent you a photo of a toy lizard that Stuart autographed for me at a public event. That had to be awkward for you, right? Like, you get this picture and this guy sends you this lizard and you're thinking, why am I getting a picture of a lizard?
I love that you recognize that. Like, most people wouldn't recognize that. But yeah, I don't remember that. Honestly, I don't remember that particular thing. But yeah,
but
we did get some awkward things.
So at the time when I got this thing, it was all I had on me. And I thought, this is Stuart McLean. I can't hand him a piece of just regular old paper. What could I give him? And I had this lizard. It was, you know, like when you get the swag from going to different booths or whatever. And
yeah,
I had gotten this lizard. So I walk up and I hand him the lizard. And I've talked about this in one of my earlier podcasts because I'm, you know, I have such a love for Stuart in the show. And, was there any, to me it's awkward, but was there any awkward or interesting fan moment from the show that you recall and you could share with us?
Yeah, we loved meeting fans. So there weren't necessarily, like, I don't think that there were no bad moments, let's put it that way. Like, we really got a lot from meeting the audience. But there is a story that I've always loved. And actually, to this day, my husband and I still joke about this. So Stuart and I did this crazy thing where we wanted, it was an idea that I had. And this is what I mean about, like, we just egged each other on. So I had this idea. I came to Stuart and I was like, let's record a show on a train. Let's, the train in some ways, it was such a fundamental part of the, the Dominion of Canada. And so let's take the train across the country. Let's write about it as we go west. And then let's turn around, come home on the same train and record a show on the train. Let's hear the tracks. Let's hear the, the hook. So this is what we did. We worked with this fantastic musician, Reed Jamison, who also did a bunch of songs about trains. And so, packed our bags, got on a train. We're probably the only two nut jobs in the world who would take a train. We got off the train for 37 minutes and turned around and came back. Most absurd thing. Anyway, it was fantastic. And somewhere along the way, you've been on a train before. Oh, I'm sure there's like the long corridors and they're narrow, right? Two people cannot pass. You have to sort of step over and let someone else pass. So we're walking along this train and I'm behind Stuart's ahead. And I just see an older guy, I don't know, maybe in his 80s. I see him walking towards Stuart and he's walking very well, but he's wobbling and the train is wobbling too. And so Stuart kind of is the one to step aside. He's a very polite guy. And I see this guy get close to Stuart. And then all of a sudden he turns and he puts one hand on one side. So Stuart's got his back to the wall. Okay. And this guy, this like older gentleman, puts one hand to the left of his head and one hand to the right. And he's standing like they are nose to nose. And he kind of leans in and he says something. And I'm like, I'm giving them some privacy, but I'm like, is this like, am I going to have to call security here? He just leans in and whispers something in his ear. And then Stuart leans in and whispers back. And then that's it. No shaking of hands, no smiles. Nothing. They just go their separate ways. So we get settled in our, at our table on the dining car. And I said, what the hell was that? And he said, guy walked up to me, put his hand on either side of my head and said, are we talking Vinyl Cafe? And I said, are we talking Vinyl Cafe? And he goes, yeah. And I said, well, what'd you say? And he goes, I said, that's exactly what we're talking. And that was that. Strangest way for someone to say, like, all the time people would say, like, are you Stuart McLean? But I just thought this, like, so fantastic. Are we talking Vinyl Cafe? And then Stuart's response to be able to come up with that on the fly, like, that's exactly what we're talking. And then boom, nothing else. Like, no conversation. They just, just pass, like two shifts in the night.
Just respect. Just respect, yeah. Jess. Yeah. Right? Wow.
So awesome.
That's so cool.
It was so great.
That's so cool. Thanks for sharing. So you've mentioned Canada a few times and 150 days on the road and taking trains and the sounds of Canada and the sights of Canada. That was a big part of it. That was a big part of the show. And I always got that from Stuart was, you know, the musical acts and the different parts of Canada that he would promote, the little towns and the big towns. Mm-hmm. And with this episode, I'm trying to focus on a little bit more of Canada, I guess, in honor of that. And I've got a musical guest named Kaylee Watts, and she's going to be capturing some sounds of Canada. So hopefully when you hear it back, you'll have a listen to that. I have a feeling like, and I became a fan of how the show would introduce some of the new musical talents across Canada. But I have a feeling that this one would be right up the Vinyl Cafe path per se. So Jess, listen, I want to thank you for sharing all the Stewart experience with us, and you know, for taking the time to do this. I do understand you've mentioned your kids a few times, that life is busy at home for you with the kids and with remote work, remote life. But what has the pandemic meant to you? If we could shift a little bit away and say, what has the pandemic meant to you as a working parent? Mm-hmm. With remote school, if there's that part or that aspect to it, you know, what are some of the joys and struggles, and how does it impact work life and home life? What advice would you have for some others who are listening that might be in the same boat with, you know, kids at home and these opportunities?
That's a really great question. Well, I don't have to do remote school, thank goodness, because I am an absolutely terrible teacher. So my youngest one is only, she's just a year and a half, so she's not in school. My eldest, Eloise, is in preschool, and it has been shut down a lot, but it was open. It's sort of been open sort of, well, I guess she was home for the first 10 months of the pandemic, and then she went back to school for a little while, and then it was shut down here for the last sort of 8 weeks or something. But we don't have to do, when she's home, there's no online learning. So I guess on the downside, there's no online learning, but on the upside, there's no online learning.
Right.
But I think, you know, I am one of the, I'm very privileged. I live out in the middle of the woods, so I have lots of space around me. And, you know, I've always worked from home when I haven't been on the road. So I have, our house right now is quite small. We have a two bedroom, and we now have two kids and two adults working at home. It's getting along right here. But I do have I used to have an office before I had two children, and now I don't have an office. But I do have a little, you know, because I'm used to working from home. What I'm trying to say is, I was set up for this already. You know, I have a desk, I have a monitor, I have all that stuff. I have a beautiful desk chair that's comfortable because I worked at home for 13 years. So I think I'm very lucky. Because I was already, you know, that trends, you know, change is hard for people.
Right.
And I was that part of it, working from home, that part I've always done. So I was used to that and set up for it. I live in the middle of the woods, so I often go several weeks without seeing anyone. So I live a bit of a hermit lifestyle when I wasn't on the road. So I was set up for it in that way. And we have space and, you know, a place to walk the dog and play with the kids and this kind of thing. So I guess I'm telling you all of that because it's easy for me to say what I'm about to say because I've had, because I'm so privileged. But for me, mostly because I am so privileged in all the ways that I just said, even though my work was affected in some ways, my husband works for the government. So we had one very steady paycheck, which I'm super grateful about. But for me, there were a lot of really positive things about this. You've probably gleaned from this conversation that I love my work and I give a lot of myself to my work. Mm-hmm. And for many, many years, that was my life. And I worked too much. And for many years, I didn't focus on a lot of relationships in my life. I'm a very social person and relationships really matter to me, but the deepest relationship I had was with my work. And, when a lot of that work was taken away because of the pandemic and also because those work relationships just, you know, everything changed. I realized how much of myself I was giving to people other than my children and my husband. And when I all of a sudden was spending 24 hours a day with my children and my husband, I realized like I should be spending more time with them. I should be giving my, you know, I should be saving my best self for the people that I love the most. And that has been a massive shift for me. And I'm super grateful to have been given the opportunity to learn that. And, we had a little baby at the beginning of COVID. So Annabelle, my youngest, was 3 months old when COVID started. And so we were all kind of in that cocooning at home sort of thing anyway. And while, it was quite a hard time to have a 3-month-old mm-hmm. and a mm-hmm. 2-year-old and no support for a year and a half. Yeah. That was, that was hard in some ways. It was also, I think, it allowed us to build the foundation of our family in a really special way. So I feel grateful for this time, and I feel grateful for the ability, I recognize the privilege that I have in being able to enjoy this time. And I hope that some of the things that have been, quite honestly, forced upon me will remain, right? Like, I hope that that forever I'll be spending this, maybe not this much time with my family, but I will be spending more time with my family. Yeah, so I feel grateful. What about you?
My daughters were asked at school, when the pandemic is over and they have to go back, what are some of the things that they're going to miss or that they enjoy right now? And the moment that got me was that my youngest first said, "Well, I'm going to miss lunchtime with Dad." And what's happened over the course of the pandemic is that I'm working from home, but I have to find some time throughout the day to make sure that they're okay, that they have everything that they need, and then we end up having lunch together. And then it's a few moments after lunch, and then it's okay, let's get ready for school, let's get ready for work. And at the end of the day we're getting the table ready and they're helping me get supper ready before mom comes home. And so those parts, but listening to you, those are beautiful insights. And I have to disagree with one thing that you said. I think that you're a great teacher. You've taught me a lot just in the time that we've been talking and all of the things that you've talked about, with being on the road and the fans and Stuart, I think that you've taught as much as you've learned, but that's just my insights in this brief conversation that I'm privileged to have with you, Jess.
Very nice, but I am a horrible teacher. If I actually ever tried to teach you, you just got to trust me on this. You wouldn't want me to teach anything.
So look, I normally, as you know, we're going to bring this thing home and you've given me a lot of your time and you've given the audience a lot of your time. I normally do a rapid fire finish and rapid fire is probably a lie because I'm not rapid at anything, but the idea is I'll say a word or two and that you would say the first thing that might come to mind. And if you're still up for that, we'll do it. And if you're not, we can skip and that's cool. But
okay. Am I supposed to say, am I answering with one word or one sentence or what?
Answer it however you most feel comfortable with it.
I'm going to do one word.
Nobody's ever done that. Okay.
Yeah, Stuart and I had a motto.
Okay.
Came from, you wouldn't know it based on this long conversation where I'm rambling, but one of his favorite authors was E.B. White, and he wrote a very famous book with another author named Strunk, Ed Strunk. Called Elements of Style, and one of the rules in it is use less words. Use fewer words. But then anyway, I am rambling because there's a piece of art. I'm not using fewer words, but in Elements of Style, I think that the rule is omit needless words is the rule. And Stuart once found a piece of art. An artist that he knew has this beautiful painting that says "Use less words," uh-huh. and that painting is now hanging in my living room. I think of him every day when I see it. So I'm going to omit needless words, and I will answer with one single word.
I'm going to have to thank you for sharing this with us. I'm going to have to follow up with you after this on this, because I like this idea of use less words. I've been trying to find ways to do that, and I'm learning.
read Strength and White, Elements of Style.
Okay, let's roll. So the first thought I have is David Morley.
Family.
Okay. On the road again.
Connection.
CBC Radio.
Home. Uh-oh. Family.
Ah. So there's a lot of interconnections here. And then my last one is family.
love.
That's interesting, because with all those single words, there's a bit of connecting the dots, which is when we started this conversation, you talked about as a producer, how you problem solve and connect the dots between ideas and people. So, Jess, I appreciate you being here to do this. Is there anything that you'd like to leave us with as we bring the segment home?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess just that, like, your question about COVID really sort of just got me thinking about stories, you know, like, and how they, you know, this has been a very difficult time for a lot of people. And I think stories help us process what we are going through. They help us make sense of the world and our experiences in it. So it's great that you're doing what you're doing, because I think this kind of a thing and, you know, talking and telling stories and listening to stories really helps us process. I don't know if you know, but the Vinyl Cafe is going to be back on the radio in the summer. I should say that, I guess.
I want to say that I thought something came across my screen about that.
Yeah.
Did it?
We just announced it.
Right. So I wasn't imagining that.
Like a few days ago or something. Yeah. And I haven't done very much, but it kind of all happened in a whirlwind. So I gotta make sure that everybody knows that. But so I guess that's, if I can retake that answer, my real answer would be, is there anything else you'd like to say? Yes, Guido, here I go. The Vinyl Cafe is going to be back in the radio. So I'm super happy about that, because a year ago we re-aired 10 episodes in the summer, and it was because of this thing that I just said, which is that stories help people process things. Like we were delighted that CBC wanted to air the show again, because we felt like,
Are we getting the regular time slot or different time slot?
No. So last summer we got the 12 noon on Sundays, which made me so happy.
Right.
But no, this year it's going to be 11 noon or 11 noon.
11.
11. You can see I'm starting to fade. 11, 11 on Sunday. So actually they're going to air the show twice every week. It'll air at 11 p.m. on Wednesdays and 11 a.m. on Sundays. So almost the same time slot. And that 11 p.m. one is interesting. We used to be on the radio on 11 p.m. on, I think it was Thursdays back in the day. And it was a totally different audience, because, you know, the people who listen Sundays. And it was just, I loved it. My brother works at a university as a custodian. He works overnight. And, you know, it made me so happy, because all of a sudden when we're on at 11 p.m., a whole bunch of people who work overnights started, and it was just a very different thing. And it just made me so happy to be able to, that a whole bunch of other people who'd never heard of the show were listening. So anyway, I hope it'll be the same this time.
But that's exciting. That's great.
Well, that's why I said home. Like one of those rapid fire questions with CBC Radio, because it just feels a little bit like a homecoming, and I'm happy about it.
That is awesome. And thank you for sharing it. So when those email blasts come out, I don't know if it was an email or if I just saw it in one of the...
I put it on Facebook.
Was that? I was trying to figure out, where did I see it? So that's you. That's you pumping those out?
Yeah. I always do. It's
awesome.
It's just me. It's just me in my basement.
Well, listen, as we did this, Stuart the Lizard is watching over us with Stuart's signature. And I just say, there you have it, folks. It is my great honor to say, Jess Milton, producer of the Vinyl Cafe Show with Stuart McLean, thanks for being here with us, sharing your own stories and memories of Stuart. What an absolute treat. Dare I say, maybe even better than Dave's Thanksgiving turkey or a Kenny Wong Scottish meat pie? Thanks, Jess.
Thank you. It was a really nice conversation.
On the heels of the discussion with Jess Milton, as we keep the content very Canadian, one of our musical featured guests for this podcast is Kaylee Watts. Kaylee Watts is a Canadian musician and songwriter, born a songbird of the wild, water, and woods. Her alto singing voice has been described as raw and hauntingly beautiful, which perfectly complements her rhythmic finger picking on acoustic guitar and her old soul as a lyricist. Kaylee captures listeners with her intimate musicality, nostalgic melodies on her vintage Wurlitzer electric piano, and her onstage performance charisma. A graduate of Carleton University's inaugural singer-songwriter Bachelor of Arts program, Kaylee has performed at several premium venues, including Ottawa's Bluefest, the infamous Black Sheep Inn at Wakefield, Quebec City, Canadian Music Week Festival in Toronto, and her debut performance at the Ottawa National Arts Centre. But don't just take my word for it. When it comes to her debut record, Smoke Lake, Pop Matters has said she's got a tremendous handle on her art and her sound is warm and convincing. If you're looking for thoughtful and quality songwriting, Smoke Lake is a good bet for those seeking maturity and wisdom at the hands of such a young woman. Couch Assassin says, the album's vision of capturing the feel of a wild, isolated place seems like a sonic analog of other ways of bottling pieces of the wild, like wildflowers pressed between glass or taxidermy, and the record carries the same aura of rarity about it. Spotlight Ottawa says, the rare poetic orchards of Smoke Lake, conceived of memory and dream, birthed in solitude and sanctuary, nurtured by bone and breath and blood and soul, surrounded by nature and ancestry. With that in mind, we're going to listen to a song called Smoke Lake from that debut album. It is the title track of Kaylee's debut album, the majority of which was recorded without electricity in her family's cabin on Smoke Lake, Algonquin Park in Ontario. It features Kaylee's exquisite vocal organic textures and field recordings of Smoke Lake soundscape. Now, I've had the privilege of visiting this cabin and watching the sun rise and set over Smoke Lake. Some mornings, as the warm water from the day before meets the cool morning air, some might say, look at the fog. But there is nothing foggy about this view, as the air appears filled with a gentle white smoke that is performing a flirtful dance with the surface of the water as it enchants you to the adventures of the day that is to come, as you are serenaded by its inhabitants. There are days when you look over Smoke Lake and it's hard to tell where the water stops and the sky starts, as its reflections serve as a reminder to our own balance. Kaylee's song, Smoke Lake, captures all of that and more, as her voice enchants you like the lake. Here is Kaylee Watts with Smoke Lake.
Before winter's ice glistened and frost petals bloomed, I was born from my mother under a crisp-bottomed moon. She gave birth to a bird. Her and my father took me to your water, sparked my hunger as a babe. On the dance of your currents, navy and gray, my wings first moved within the bay. And that's when smoke. Swallow me whole. The echo from your cedar ribbons spreaded my song among the wild. The silence spoke to me splendor. I found purpose as a child. And your smoke poured from my throat. Ooh. When I am old and can no longer speak, bring me to your wood to be in your peace. Lay down my bones upon your shore. Let the smoke hover over and swallow me whole. Smoke, swallow me whole. Smoke, swallow me whole. Smoke, smoke, swallow me
whole. That's Kaylee Watts with Smoke Lake. And I've always loved the ending of that song, how you can hear her walk through that cabin and open the door and head out towards the lake. As we observe our Canadian roots, we must also reflect on some of those roots where change is needed. On the Tkemloops de Shoempek website, on May 27, 2021, Chief Roseanne Casimir says this. She confirms an unthinkable loss that was spoken about but never documented by the Kamloops Indian Residential School. This past weekend, with the help of a ground-penetrating radar specialist, the stark truth of a preliminary findings came to light. The confirmation of the remains of 215 children who were students of the Kamloops Indian Residential School. We're going to take a 2-minute and 15-second pause in reflection, in remembrance, in the hopes that as we begin the conversation, it's just the start of a journey for healing within Canada, for the families, for the children who were lost and found, and will never be forgotten. Please join me in this 2-minute and 15-second pause as we observe and remember the 215 children and their lives. All right. Now, as we continue the show, I'd like to take you from the shores of Smoke Lake to the shores of the Great Lakes with our next guest. But before we do that, let's hear from a couple of our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Richard Chase, introducing Chaser's Fresh Juice, a local business in Toronto. We've been in business for over 20 years, initially supporting our local Toronto area and now servicing all of Canada. Chaser provides fresh organic juices, ingredients, including citrus zests, dehydrated garnishes, and fresh citrus peels to enhance any cocktail or recipe you can think of. We have successfully supplied restaurants, distilleries, craft breweries, and bakeries across the country. Reach out to orders@chasersjuice.com for any questions you may have. We are a customized fresh juice company, and I'm sure we can help you. Thank you.
Recipes at My Table is a work of family, love of food, and sharing of stories. The stories keep the memories alive and make every day a party in my kitchen. Join me for the sharing of traditional Italian recipes and so much more. Visit me at www.recipesatmytable.com.
I'd like to welcome to the podcast Peter Greve from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, Canada, who will be talking to us about surfing on the Great Lakes. Peter has been surfing for a few years now in Lake Superior, Huron, and Erie, while also working as a canoe guide on Lake Superior. Peter's currently a student attending Western University in London, Ontario, and studying to be a registered nurse. Peter, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Yesterday, I actually got out to go surfing in the morning, so I'm a bit sore from that, but definitely happy about being able to get out.
I was going to ask you, did you go surfing today? But so you went yesterday and you took a break, and it sounds like you're a little achy, but you're still able to talk with us.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I always seem to find time to make a trip to the lake to surf. So I'm glad I was able to do that in the end of May, which is rare.
So we're going to talk a little bit about that and the season and things like that. So I understand you've taken up surfing on the Great Lakes, and something I didn't know that was even possible. And that's weird because, you know, I grew up on the lakes of the shore of Lake Superior up in, you know, Red Rock up in Sault Ste. Marie, and spent a lot of my childhood up there. And I never, you know, having lived to see, you know, all those waves and storms, I never would have thought, hey, grab a surfboard and surf. But what made you think of doing that?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you mentioned Red Rock, because when I saw the waves out there as a young kid, I remember thinking about surfing there. And I remember actually taking photos, and they're some of the first photos on my Facebook profile, which is kind of different. But generally, what made me think of surfing, I grew up competitive swimming. I did a lot of canoeing, spent a lot of time at the lake at my camp. I loved to play in the waves in the water all day, especially if it was warm, but even if it was cold, which kind of ties in well with freshwater surfing. I think the surfing has a lot of culture. So there's a lot of films that people reference. It's like the Aloha spirit and all that. But freshwater surfing itself, I think it's a little bit more niche. Being in the Great Lakes, it's a little bit more undefined. So you can kind of make it what you want it. It's challenging. And it's a unique part of our region. It's one of the only places in Canada and in the world where you can surf on a lake. So that's pretty special.
So is there an industry, like, is it a known industry up in Sault Ste. Marie that people could come there to surf?
Not at all. There are very few surfers to begin with. It is really niche. Usually when I'm out, it's a couple friends that I'm with, if that. One of my friends though runs a smaller surf shop. It's snowboard in the winter, surf in the summer, and think he also does a few other things. But there are a lot of smaller surf shops like that. In Toronto, there's a couple large surf shops that have taken off in the last 5 years or so that have gotten really large. You can see people down at the Bluffs, Scarborough Bluffs, surfing too. So it's definitely growing, I think, mostly in Southern Ontario on the Great Lakes, but up on Lake Superior, it isn't so much an industry, I would say, but it's a hobby of a few people, at least.
What made you, you said, when you were a child, you looked at the waves on Lake Superior and you thought about surfing, but between that and actually stepping on a board and going onto the lake, what was the trigger? When did you say, I'm going to grab this board and I'm going on that lake? Like, when did that happen?
Yeah. So the moment I kind of transitioned, I started stand up paddle boarding a lot. And so that was more fun to do on waves. And I remember being at Catherine's Cove and just going endlessly back and forth, with my surfboard or my stand up paddle board. And going home that day and being like, this would be something that I would like to do in the future. It was the idea of exploring and figuring it out, because you didn't see people surfing in our area. And then I found online there was a surfer gathering in Terrace Bay. So Terrace Bay is about 5 hours north of Sault Ste. Marie.
Yes.
And
closer to Thunder Bay, right?
Yeah, exactly. Probably 3 hours east of Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
And there was a gathering there, and it was organized on Facebook. And so I was planning on going, and there are these people with wetsuits, you know, proper boards, the knowledge of where to surf, how to surf, all that stuff. And I was here just kind of doing it on my own with a stand-up. And I was heading up to go. It was in the fall. And one of the guys who was giving out rentals for the people who were attending, he said, hey, you should connect with someone near Sault Ste. Marie. They also give out rentals, do rentals, sell boards, et cetera, et cetera. So his name was Vessa, and he runs East Superior Board Shop, which I referenced earlier. So I got in touch with him, and that's kind of how my surfing journey took off a little bit more. As soon as I met up with him and got in the right gear to go all year round,
right,
I found surfing really enjoyable.
We're gonna talk about the seasons of surfing. So, all right. So you've transitioned. You've made your childhood thoughts come to reality. You picked up some equipment. Now surfing on the Great Lakes, that's different than, let's say, surfing in the ocean, which is, you know, I grew up watching movies of the Big Kahuna, right? And he's on a surfboard in the ocean. But do you have, like, what's the difference, or and do you have a different type of awareness between the lake and the ocean? And I'm making an assumption that you've surfed on the ocean, or you know more about the ocean as compared to the lake, and are there different safety concerns or tips between the two?
Yeah, this is a great question. I could go very in depth, but I'll kind of keep it on the surface. I have surfed in the ocean, so I've surfed. I made a trip out to Tofino, which is called the surfing capital of Canada. I'm sure people on the east coast of Canada might argue with them. somewhere on Nova Scotia might compare, but there is a vibe out there for surfing.
And where is that? Where is this?
Tofino is on the very west coast of Vancouver Island.
Wow.
So I'm trying to think, like, Nanaimo is somewhere people might be familiar with. It's on the east side, and it's directly west. I want to say 2 hours, maybe.
Okay. So we're out on the west coast. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, British Columbia. Sorry, I should mention the province too. Yeah, so differences between freshwater surfing and ocean surfing, there are a lot less people. So if you go to Tofino, there are quite a few people trying to catch the same waves. On lakes, it's a little bit less crowded. The saltwater itself you're a little bit more buoyant in it, so it's a little bit more difficult to surf on the lakes. The waves tend to be a little bit smaller, a little bit messier on the lakes. They're driven by wind, as opposed to on the ocean, you could have a storm off the coast of Asia and it'll drive swell all the way over to Vancouver Island a day later or so.
And what is swell? What is that?
I guess you just describe it as it's the momentum of energy. It's inertia. So all of that storm energy is transferred into the water. And as the water, that energy comes up towards shore, it's lifted up into waves. Hmm. I like physics and I like the physics behind it, but I'm not well.
No, that's
well
okay. So in the ocean, you get more of the swell is what you're saying. More of this sort of this drive energy within the water. But on the Great Lakes, it's what's happening above the water. It's the winds.
Yeah. So okay. Similar idea, right? So the larger the stretch of water that the wind can act on, which we call fetch, the greater potential there is for wind swell. So it's a different type of swell.
Got it.
But it'll build up waves to greater heights. And then depending on where you are along the shore, the bottom of the lake actually lifts up the water. As it slopes up to land, it lifts up the waves.
So is it harder to surf on a freshwater lake than it is in the ocean?
Yeah. Okay. Generally, so you don't float as well. Same with your boards. And generally, the waves are a little bit closer together, but they can be smaller. One of the pros I like to point out is that when I'm in Lake Superior, especially, I can drink the water while I'm surfing. You can get a little bit more dehydrated on the ocean. So there's one pro. When you're looking out from shore, it's also a little bit weird because in all the surfing movies, you see palm trees and all these things.
Right.
And when you're in Canada surfing, even on the West Coast, you see pine trees, you see, it's just different. It's a different vibe. And then also the weather. So on the Great Lakes, usually you're surfing an actual storm. So it could be snowing, it could be raining sideways. There's rainbows sometimes, it's cloudy. Very rarely sunny. And then on the West Coast or anywhere on the ocean, really, that people surf, they usually look for nice weather, right? They time it with the tides too, things like that. But more or less, we're dealing with a little bit more extreme weather.
It sounds a little dangerous.
Yeah, maybe to circle back to the safety concerns. Because there's less people, the waves are a little bit closer together, more remote places. You are often surfing in sub-zero temperatures. It's definitely more risky. And I would, definitely recommend people listening that they research well and then make sure they go with someone who's also into surfing or has strong swimming skills. I'd say those are some prerequisites.
I think, that's probably something to emphasize is the strong swimming skills. Now, you keep referencing weather, and I've seen some pictures of you, and it looks like you're surfing in the winter. Is there an actual surfing season? You just said you went yesterday. But is there a season where you go, this is the surfing season and everything else is just a bonus?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I would say fall and winter you're going to get the most storms, and just the way the systems work out, it's more frequent where we get waves that are really surfable, and this time of year, much less so, but it's still kind of an all year round sport. So I'm always looking through, trolling the weather to see if there's potential in the next week, if it lines up with my schedule, what lake I can surf. But I would say September, October is the sweet spot because the water is still warm and you get those big storms coming through.
And so you've referenced the temperature and some of the conditions. And I was going to say, well, do you need any special equipment to surf, or is it just you and the board? But when you're surfing, you said, sometimes it's sub-zero temperatures. I've been in that lake. It doesn't stay that warm in October. And when I say that lake, Lake Gichigumi, right, Lake Superior, it doesn't stay that warm. So, is there is there a special suit or, I mean, you're not wearing shorts like the guys out in California, right?
Almost never. Yesterday, I just went with bottoms for about a half hour at the end, and I was starting to get a little bit cold, and it was about 15 degrees. The air temperature was about 15, and I'd say the water maybe was around 8 degrees. Typically, when we're in the water, it is pretty close to 0 degrees, so you need a wetsuit. You have booties, mitts, and a hood, so you're almost completely covered in neoprene that's anywhere between 3 millimeters and 6 millimeters thick. The thicker suits are for sub-zero temperatures, like minus 10, minus 15. Oh, you have icicles growing on your face. Some people have ice beards. It's pretty gnarly.
Really?
Yeah.
So the suits that you wear in the winter are different than what you would have wore yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, when I first started out, I just had one suit. And then, you know, take down the hood or don't wear gloves and boots. But you can, it's a lot easier if you can go with a thinner suit in the warmer months because you're a bit lighter. All that neoprene kind of soaks up water too. So you're adding to your weight. Oh. And then same thing with the buoyancy, right? You're even heavier. You want to be as light as possible.
Now you said boots, and I've always envisioned surfing your barefoot. I guess you're never barefoot in the Great Lakes.
So yesterday I was able to on Lake Huron, but yeah, it's definitely a better feel if you can actually have your feet on the board. But if you can't feel your toes, then you can't feel the board. So the boots kind of help keep you warm.
Right.
Those are probably the first things that get cold is your feet and your hands, I would say.
So where do you pick up stuff like this? Well, let's start with a surfboard. Is there a certain type of surfboard you use or would you ever consider making your own or anything like that?
So East Superior Board Shop, I've gotten most of my boards either used or a couple of new ones I traded. A longer board is really nice because it has a little bit more volume to be able to stay afloat in smaller waves. So you can surf a variety of things. As you get into more maneuvers and stuff, it's nice to have a shorter board. So I have a couple of mid-length and a short board.
Oh.
And I built my own board. It's a cedar strip style board. So my dad made a cedar strip canoe when I was really young.
Uh-huh.
And so we used the same technique. We worked together and built, it's a hollow surfboard made of cedar wood that's really light, about, let's say, a quarter inch thick, even less after we sanded it. And then it's fiberglass, so it's an epoxied, so it's completely waterproof. And yeah, that was a really special thing to be able to
Did make your own board.
Yeah. Even the fins and everything. Yeah.
How long did that process take?
I want to say I started in March 2020, and I had it finished or near finished in June.
All right.
Yeah.
So a few months, and I mean, you're probably doing other things in between. Now, this board, do you use that, the homemade board, the one that you made, do you use that in a special part of the season or in a special circumstance?
I really like it when I can go barefoot because it has a really nice feel to it.
Yeah.
It's a mid-length board, so it's 7.5 feet long, so you can surf it in a lot of different conditions. And I exclusively surf it on Lake Superior, mostly because I don't want to break it down here and then not be able to fix it. It's nice to have like the equipment to be able to repair stuff. So the second time I had it out, I blew a fin on it because I made my own fins.
Right.
And so that was also, it's all a learning process as well. Learning about the materials and how thick to make things, and I didn't make my fins nearly thick enough, so I busted a couple fins.
And those were replaceable, it sounds like.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
So it again, we're along the lines and thoughts here of the conditions that you're surfing in. Lake Superior, there's parts of Lake Superior that are quite rocky. Have you ever wiped out or gotten injured? And I'm thinking of those rocky shores, and other lakes might be similar, but I know there's parts of Lake Superior where it's very sandy. So, where are you on the wipeout or injury front with surfing?
So I will say I've had plenty of wipeouts, and luckily zero injuries. There are some trickier spots, like you mentioned. A lot of the East Superior shore is rocky. There are some nice beaches there that we do frequent, but a lot of times, yeah, you're near rock ledges, rocky bottom, rocky beaches. So it's really important to go with someone who knows the area, go when there isn't waves, because as soon as it gets chaotic and wavy and windy and snowing, right, and icy and slippery, you're taking greater risks. So yeah, I would say it's mostly about positioning yourself so you're not in those high risk areas and knowing where the hazards are in the water. But for the most part, the water really breaks your fall. So even during a wipeout, it's not quite like landing in snow, but it catches you, if that makes sense. And
right,
it's if you're anticipating how it's moving, it's actually kind of fun. I enjoy that part. Yeah.
You're kind of going with the flow, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. As long as you don't panic, and you enjoy kind of being in the water and sometimes having to hold your breath, it can be fun.
So I have this vision, you know, somebody surfing and there's this ginormous wave, and I've seen, you know, like, and again, I'm only referencing movies. I've never surfed. But they get swallowed up by the wave. Has that ever happened? And if that's happened, like, what's that experience like?
Yeah. So usually as you're paddling out, you have to paddle through a lot of waves. So there's the potential there. And there's a few different techniques that you can kind of use so you don't get pulled in with the flow or the power of the wave. So one of them is called a duck dive. I love that name.
Duck dive?
Duck dive. Duck dive.
Okay.
Yeah, the surfing slang, it's pretty unique. I like the words they use, or came up with, rather. So a duck dive, you push the nose of the board down, and you actually you kind of do a parabolic dive underneath the wave as it's coming. So you miss all the energy that's being transferred through the water. You go underneath it, which is kind of a savvy way to get through and not be swallowed by a wave. Some people, when you get more advanced, when you're catching the wave itself, sometimes it'll actually swallow you as you're trying to ride down it. It closes out on you, or the wave curls over top. And sometimes it even pulls you back up the wave and crashes down again. So you go kind of in a spin cycle. They call that going over the falls. It's another slang term for you. But most times, so there's all different ways you can kind of get caught in a wave, similar to how you're describing. But most of the time, if you kind of just you're attached to a buoyant object, which is your surfboard, by a leash, and in your wetsuit, you're kind of buoyant. So as long as you can kind of ride it out and hold your breath, not panic, you surface. And the feeling, I don't know how I describe the feeling. It sounds pretty incredible. There's like a lot of crashing water around you. You can't really see anything because there's a lot of white water, and yeah, usually icy cold water on your face. So it could be a shock.
Can you get lost in the wave?
Yeah, it's totally possible. Sometimes it's hard to tell which way is up. And sometimes the waves are close enough together, so the distance between the waves is measured in time. It's called the period. And so typically on the Great Lakes, or on Lake Superior, I'll say a good day is 7 seconds in between waves. So you have about 7 seconds to get up, orient yourself on your board, and start moving and avoid the next wave. Whereas on the ocean, sometimes that period is closer to 12 seconds plus.
Wow.
So that's another difference, I would say, surfing on the Great Lakes in Canada.
Peter, I feel like I've been on a surfboard with you. My heart is racing a little bit as I'm thinking about being on the board and the waves and all these sorts of cool things that are happening. I don't think I would ever be brave enough myself to try it, but it sounds like a pretty Canadian thing to do. that you're out on this, you know, sub-zero temperatures and embracing, you know, the seasons that we have in this country. Is there anything that you'd want to say in addition to anything I've asked today or that I haven't asked maybe? I'm certainly not the expert, but I'm certainly more educated after talking to you. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah, I'll add that I'm still learning too, and it's a really fun sport to be learning in. And I love that comment about embracing the weather, because I think that's one of the staples of surfing on the fresh water and the Great Lakes, is embracing the weather, being prepared for it, and then how empowering that is in someone's life. I've noticed a huge difference in how I approach different outdoor activities, because if you have the right gear, it can be the difference between, you know, having hypothermia, try to surfing in your board shorts on Lake Superior in about 15 minutes, or you have a wetsuit and you can surf for 4 hours. So it just changes your mindset about risk and safety and how we enjoy the outdoors. So I think I'd like to end on that note. I like the word choice, embracing, and we're all still learning.
Well, there you have it, folks. We have been fetching, wind swelling, duck diving, and gone over the falls with Peter Greve, Canadian Great Lakes surfer, taking advantage of some of the most natural water wonders of the world, from Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, Canada. Thank you for doing this with us, Peter. Take care.
You're welcome, yeah, and thank you for having me. It was awesome talking about surfing with you today.
Thanks, Peter.
Now, earlier we heard from Kaylee Watts singing Smoke Lake, and now we've got another song from her called Ophelia. Shortly after her graduation from Carleton, Kaylee had an opportunity to travel to Scotland and England with her father and trace the birthplace and history of her ancestors. While there, she visited the gravesite of William Shakespeare, a distant relative on the Watts family tree. Ophelia is an ode to William Shakespeare's imagery and to the eerie and ethereal nature of his character, Ophelia. Here's Kaylee Watts with her song, Ophelia.
Dips a shoe into the pool. So recklessly she sought her pride. The icy sheet spread to her knees, to the tender hands that could not achieve. Bites her lip and creeps a little deeper, little deeper. Ooh. In time she'll see, meantime she sighs. In time she'll see, meantime she sighs. She cries, rivers for the wicked, oceans for the cruel, commends all the commoners who take her for a fool. Ooh. She breathes a baby's breath, clings to the air above the current. She floats above her casket, drifts above her tomb, infected by the wreckage that brought this ardent bed of doom. Ooh. In time she'll see, meantime she sighs. In time she'll see, meantime she sighs. She cries, rivers for the wicked, oceans for the cruel, commends all the commoners who take. Meantime she'll see. Meantime she'll say. In time she'll see. Meantime she sighs. She cries. Rivers for the wicked. Oceans for the cruel. Commands all the common. So take her for a fool. In time she'll see, meantime she sighs. In time she's free, meantime she dies.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's Kaylee Watts with her song, Ophelia. This extended single of Ophelia, along with Kaylee's first record, Smoke Lake, as well as her follow-up record, Hung Me Dry, are available on iTunes, Spotify, and through Kaylee's website, KayleeWatts.com. I'm going to have all of those links for you available in the podcast notes, and I hope that you check out this talented young Canadian songbird, and we thank her for joining us here on the show today. All right, we've come to the part of the show where I might normally tell you a story, either about myself or an experience that I've had to share with you, and we're going to change that up just a little bit for this episode, and maybe in the future, we'll see. What I'm going to share with you today is an essay from a blog that I have written and is available on guidoparino.com, and I'll have that link available to you as well in the podcast notes. So today's topic is freedom of expression and COVID-19. I hope you enjoy it. When my car breaks down, I go to a mechanic. If my hair gets too long for my liking, I go to a barber. If my elbow hurts when I bend it, I go to a doctor. You get the idea, right? I mean, I've tried fixing my own car, cutting my own hair, and diagnosing my aching elbow. And I've achieved some moderate success with each, but nothing as long-term or as convincing as those who do those things by trade and experience. I admit, even moderate self-success feels exhilarating. And one positive to come out of the COVID-19 pandemic is the global rediscovery of self-care and sustainment opportunities. But there are still some times when we don't quite have all of the right information or tools to do it like the pros. So what makes that logic so hard to accept when it comes to COVID-19? Why is there a contingency of people protesting the use of masks, which science tells us will help reduce the spread of the virus? What makes people post antiquated articles from experts who, when you dig a little bit deeper into their biography, haven't worked in the medical or scientific industry in almost a decade, or have left one of the leading industries under terms that may require further consideration, but are pushing unfounded theories of mass genetic altering vaccines or global political conspiracy? Even further, you can find people spreading fear through dated pandemic articles when information was just emerging, or quoting information out of context in some deep desire to provide an ill-informed point that just might challenge general common sense. The reasons for this may range from a variety of social behaviors, some more serious than others, and beyond the scope of this reflection. What is within its scope, in summary, is consideration for factual information from the medical and scientific community, supported by real-life experiences. So let me get a few foundational facts out of the way, supported by our global professional communities. COVID-19 is a real infectious coronavirus disease. The virus is transmitted through some form of direct contact from the respiratory droplets of an infected human to another human, and crowds tend to be one of the perfect environments for spreading it. The virus can be spread by someone who is not showing any symptoms, i.e. asymptomatic, no symptoms at all, or pre-symptomatic, hasn't developed symptoms yet. The virus that causes COVID-19 is not the same virus that causes the flu, which is why a different vaccine is required. I believe these facts, based on evidence over the course of the past year or so, as it's validated through multiple credible sources that are available to all, including the idea that vaccines would help the world overcome this pandemic. The initial complement of vaccines for COVID-19 have required two doses spread over some predetermined period of time. After the first dose, each provides a varying level of vaccine efficacy, which according to Shelley McNeil, MD from the Canadian Centre for Vaccinology in Halifax, Nova Scotia, is the percent reduction in disease incidence in a vaccinated group compared to an unvaccinated group under optimal conditions. McNeil also points out that vaccine effectiveness is the ability of a vaccine to prevent outcomes of interest in the real world. These are important definitions as the vaccine transitions from a very ideal and controlled environment to the one we live in every day. When that happens, a variety of other elements get introduced that could impact the overall results. Vaccines generally help by reducing the symptom impacts and preventing hospitalization and/or preventing death. If a vaccine has an efficacy rate of 95%, that means it is still possible to contract COVID-19, but the likelihood of severe impact will be greatly reduced. A current trend among non-medical experts who seem to leverage medical data only when it best serves their point of view has been fixated on published data that some people are contracting COVID-19 2 weeks after their first vaccine dose and are using that as a jumping board to spread further misinformation about the vaccine's value or intent. In fairness, I can't find anywhere in the vaccine documentation that you're fully protected with one dose in a two-dose vaccine. What I do find is recommendations that after your first dose, you should still observe social distancing, wear your mask, and wash your hands. On May 25th, 2021, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention advised that people are fully vaccinated 2 weeks after their second shot in a two-dose series like Pfizer or Moderna vaccines, or 2 weeks after a single-shot vaccine like Johnson & Johnson's Janssen COVID-19 vaccine, and continue with, you are not fully vaccinated if it has been less than 2 weeks since your one-dose shot. It has been less than 2 weeks since your second shot of a two-dose vaccine, or you still need to get your second dose of a two-dose vaccine. So it seems that those who are trying to disprove the effectiveness of the vaccine by pointing out that people can still contract COVID-19 after their first dose are actually supporting the scientific and medical community data that suggests that it is indeed a possibility. But they often leave out that it also supports the reduction of symptoms, hospitalization, and death. The other really important fact overlooked by some of those still struggling to accept COVID-19 as a real global pandemic is how hospitalization impacts and strains medical services in terms of capacity capability, reduction in secondary medical care, and the imposition of life and death choices. The influx of COVID-19 patients, specifically the ICU, intensive care unit, has pushed the hospitals to the brink of capacity and care. On March 23, 2021, CBC reported that from December 2020 through to March, 509 COVID-19 patients had been transferred to another ICU unit in Ontario because of capacity issues. Along with the healthcare aspects of that transition is an associated financial, mental, and physical cost of the patient, their family, and all of the healthcare providers. As hospital ICUs get filled, medical staff are forced to shift their focus away from other medical services, impacting other treatable conditions for heart and stroke, cancer, and more. In March 2021, CTV reported that at least 353,913 surgeries, procedures, and specialist consultations were postponed across Canada due to COVID-19 in the first few months of the pandemic. Imagine the impact of that over the course of the full pandemic and globally. This further spills into ethical decision-making based on prioritization. A recent personal family experience had paramedics asking the question of an 87-year-old man suspected of having a heart attack if he wanted to go to the hospital. Think about that for a moment in our sophisticated modern world. A man who was in medical distress being asked to make a decision if he wanted to go to the hospital as paramedics evaluated the pandemic environment and impact on hospital resources. I cannot find any data to support any such similar type of impacts caused by the flu, or the flu being a cause to prioritize patients going to the hospital or not, in a life or death moment of decision making or impacting hospital resources and surgeries in the way COVID-19 has. All these facts aside, it's important to acknowledge that in Canada, everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, including freedom of the press and other media of communication, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, Section 2B. It is indeed a valuable right, and a right that deserves great responsibility and care in all circumstances, especially when dealing with the well-being of humanity. I hope that right finds in each of us reasonability, collaboration, and compassion for one another. Okay, before we get to our final musical guest of the show, a quick word from our sponsor, Johnny Prosciutto. Johnny Prosciutto, artisanal Italian homemade products. We make it like our grandfather, or as we say, nonno. Naturally cured, old-fashioned, and delicious. The best part? We deliver straight to your front door. We offer free shipping when spending over $99. Order online at johnnyprosciutto.com and stay safe. And when you use the code GUIDORocks, you're going to get $25 off your entire purchase. That's at johnnyprosciutto.com. All right, as we continue our Canadian music journey, I've got a special presentation here from a duo called Frankly Speaking. This Canadian duo of Frank Greco and Frank Gioia have been entertaining audiences under the identity of Frankly Speaking, staging concerts and shows throughout Ontario at major festivals and countless venues. The musicians love to create, arrange, and perform originals, as well as put their own spin to cover songs from folks like Elton John, Lady Gaga, The Beatles, Queen, Prince, and many more. The artists produced the highly acclaimed multimedia show Rock On to the Sound of Change and provided the musical backdrop for The Imposter, starring illusionist Ryan McFarlane. Now, Gioia's love of singing was inherited from his Calabria-born mother, as she would sing her favorite Italian songs, Marina and Volare. This powerful and gracious vocalist attributes his style to classical training and a deep passion for all genres of music. Now, Gioia continues to evolve as an artist through his interpretation of new ideas and is always motivated to make connections with diverse audiences. Greco is a classically trained stardella and chromatic accordion player. His interest was ignited after a trip to Italy with his nonno at 8 years of age, hearing the beautiful sounds of Calabria for the first time. Over the years, he received numerous awards, both at local and nationwide competitions. Spring forward to his young adulthood, and it was time to play the keys for bands covering hits from the 80s and 90s. Frank Greco has also accompanied talented Italian singers Armando Polente and Fabio Trioli, breathing new life into Italian classics. Now, the song I have for you today from the duo is called O Solo Mio. During the COVID isolation, the two discovered themselves searching through their past Italian heritage for creative inspiration. Now, they are excited to have audiences enjoy their latest production of O Solo Mio. The musicians wanted to create a version of the classical great with a distinctive feel from many past versions. Now, Greco combined different minor chords and melodies to the piano arrangement, as Gioia attempted to include moments of softness and build suspense to the overall production. So without further ado, here is Frankly Speaking with O Solo Mio.
Mana tu sole, più bello in me, O sole mio, stai a fronte a te. Che bella cosa, n'hai nata sole, Daria serena dopo una tempesta, e l'aria fresca per già una festa. Che bella cosa una giornata e sole. Mamma, tu sole più bello in me, o sole mio, stai a fronte a te. Oh sole mio, stai a fronte a te, stai a fronte a te. Luceno lastre da finestra toia, na lavanara canta e se ne vanta. Sotto finestra toia reste aria, quando fa notte o sole se ne scine. O sole mio, stai a fronte a te. O sole mio, stai a fronte a te, stai a fronte a te. Manna tu sole, o sole mio, stai a fronte a te. O sole mio, stai a fronte a te, stai a fronte a te. O sole mio, stai in fronte a te.
That was truly a beautiful rendition of O Sole Mio by the Canadian duo of Frank Greco and Frank Gioia, known as Frankly Speaking. There's also a video that accompanies this song, and I'll include in the podcast notes a link to that. And in the video production, the song impressions blend to the dance movement and physical articulation of ballerina Maria Astrid Mentz. It runs through a roller coaster of emotions, and we discover a talented, strong, and beautiful lady. Maria Astrid Mentz is a senior artist and a member of Ballet Black in London, UK. She was born in Paris, France, where she began her dance journey. Unfortunately, during her younger years, it was often full of confusion as she struggled in an industry that fails to see past skin color. Today, Marie has grown into an established dancer and received much attention and praise by the industry. She has been a principal dancer in numerous productions. The video of the ballerina was created by multi-talented British director, dancer, and choreographer Rebecca Murray. Rebecca also directed and starred in her own creative dance piece for Dance On, an online entertainment platform in LA. Look for the link. And again, thank you to Frankly Speaking for sharing that with us today. All right, folks, thank you for joining me. That concludes the June podcast. I really appreciate you tuning in and listening. Stay safe and hope to see you next month. Take care, everybody.